Torah. So you might get the impression superficially that there are no new mitzvos in the book of Devarim at all. And yet there are many, many mitzvos that don't appear anywhere else in the whole Torah, and many of them are in this parsha. And, you know, people raise the question, we know that Tayyad mitzvos, 613 mitzvos, have a very important significance. We have 248 mitzvos asay, positive commandments, thou shalt do, and we have 365 negative commandments, thou shalt not do. And Chazal ascribed a mystical significance to these numbers. The 248 are the limbs of a person, the bones of the skeleton, and the 365 are the sinews and nerves in the body. And each mitzvah brings light and life, spiritual life and connection to Hashem, to a limb or to a sinew. So the question becomes, there is no Jew, as we know, that can do 613 commandments.
Right.
Some of them are only for the Kohanim.
And then some of them are from the Beit HaMikdash.
Some of the Beit HaMikdash today, certainly we don't have that ability. That's right. So how is it possible for a person, as it were, to get the spiritual life of a mitzvah if we can't do it? So the answer that the Meforshim say is there are two ways we get the chiyus. The chiyus is the spiritual life of the mitzvah. One is through learning. Because even the mitzvahs that I cannot do b'maisa, I can do vicariously through Talmud Torah. For example, the Gemara says, one who learns about korbanos, one who learns about sacrifices, gets the merits of sacrifice. So in effect, therefore, one of the important dimensions of Talmud Torah, and perhaps I would suggest this would even be true, women technically are exempt from Talmud Torah, but one could raise the speculation, because I've never seen anyone say it, that even if there's a technical exemption in Talmud Torah would be important for women too, among other reasons, because it gives women the opportunity to fulfill, just as for men, those mitzvos that we're unable to do, which is why the Chafetz Chaim made the point that some people say, why do we bother learning about korbanos today? It's not relevant. It's not nogeya lemaisa. The Chafetz Chaim made a point that sometimes it's even more important to learn those things that you're unable to do, because that is the only way you get the spiritual aura of those commandments. That is one answer. The second answer is through unity and Avas Yisrael. How is that so? Because Avas Yisrael links me to my fellow Jews. I become part of a cosmic entity that transcends past, present, and future. And therefore, I as an individual cannot do many mitzvahs. But when I'm linked to Klal Yisrael, everybody, in other words, the mitzvahs of a woman are my mitzvahs, the mitzvahs of a man are women's mitzvahs, the mitzvahs of the Kohen hundreds of years ago are my mitzvahs. Linkage. In fact, I saw one of the Svarim gave a very ingenious interpretation that might be Hillel's answer to the Goy. In other words, Hillel asks the Goy, the Goy asks Hillel, teach me the whole Torah on one foot. The Lashon was regel achas. So some people interpret regel. Regel can also mean pa'am, teach me the whole Torah at one time. Meaning, what is the one thing I can do which will enable me to keep the whole Torah? The one thing that I can do to keep the whole Torah. So Hillel told him two things. But look at this. The first thing Hillel told him was, Ma desani lach, what is hateful to you, do not do to another. That refers to loving your fellow man. Now look at the next phrase. The next phrase is totally different translation. The next phrase goes, Idach, which we always translate, and the rest, Zeal, Gomorrah, go and learn. But the way they translate it is the following. The Idach, and what is the other way you can keep the whole Torah? Zeal, Gemor, go and learn. In other words, he's picking up the two ways, Avas Yisrael and Talmud Torah. The Idach is way number two. That's how he translates it. Not as we normally say, and the rest. Idach, method number two, Zeal, Gemor. So it's interesting that the question becomes, is there an inyan that a person should seek out opportunities to do mitzvos which don't appear to be obligations? For example, let's take Shiluach HaKein. We read in yesterday's Parsha that there's a mitzvah that says if you encounter a bird's nest with birds or eggs in it, so you're not allowed to take the mother and the children, you should send away the mother and then take the children. Now, let's assume I'm not in the business of collecting birds. That's not what I do. Is there an inyan for any of us to look for a bird's nest? Actually, the halakhas are very complicated. You think, you know, you see a bird's nest sometimes, but it only applies to a female bird, and some species, the male actually sits on the eggs for a while, and it's hard to know the difference. But is there an inyan to seek out the performance of these nests? Another example, get is a mitzvah in the Torah. There's a mitzvah of get. We don't say seek it out. You know, yes, you seek it out, generally speaking. So,
what is the mitzvah of get?
Well, the mitzvah of get means that if a couple decides to divorce, there's a commandment in the Torah that it be done in a religious way. But nobody's going to suggest that that's a mitzvah that one says, I have to do this. Even symbolically, one is not going to tell a husband or a wife, every morning I should give my wife a get to fulfill the mitzvah of get, and then we'll remarry again. I mean, in other words, certain mitzvahs, we don't understand them as something you seek out. And yet, Kabbalistically, it's a little strange, because if I say each mitzvah brings a certain light into the world, so what are you going to say? So the mitzvah of Gershon does something as well. And yet, that's so obviously inconsistent with the Mizbeach, we say, the altar cries. I mean, obviously, it's not a mitzvah. Although somebody told me, this is a totally different reason, that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you know, there's a halach in Shulchan Aruch that says that if a person was married for 10 years and did not have children, then under the strict letter of the halacha, since the man, assuming that the man does not have a physical problem that would stop him from having children, under the strict halacha, he should divorce his wife and marry another one in order to try to fulfill the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiplying. Sephardim don't have to do that, because Sephardim are allowed to have more than one wife, but Ashkenazim would have a dilemma.
Does the wife also have the other way around after 10 years?
The wife does
she
not.
She doesn't have children, but she will be related to also.
No, because the mitzvah of being fruitful and multiply is only on the man, not on the woman. The woman does not have a mitzvah, although the woman is the one that procreates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's brought down, though. The Ramah says that Bisman Hazeh.
The woman doesn't have the mitzvah.
No. A woman is not obligated. No, a woman has a mitzvah if she has children. She's not obligated to have children. It's an obligation on
but
the.
But she's the only one who can carry children.
No.
So that it doesn't make sense.
No. It makes sense. In other words, what that means to say is the following: a man must look for a mate who is willing to have children. But the woman can decide. The woman can decide. In other words, it's halakhically permissible for a woman to say, I don't want to get married. It's not desirable, so to speak, but a woman has the right to decide not to have children. But a man is obligated to find a mate who is willing to cooperate in having children. It's interesting, the Mesher Chachma gives two reasons for this, by the way. Why is a woman exempt? One reason is, he says the following. He says, number one is the maternal instinct, that men have to be commanded to have kids, because it's not something they would instinctively do. A woman doesn't need a mitzvah. But the other reason he says is the opposite, a very interesting reason. He says, childbirth is dangerous. I mean, Baruch Hashem, by and large, in our modern hospitals, etc., you know, we're not as aware of childbirth as being...
It still happens.
It still happens. But you know, one doesn't realize that for most of history, it was an extremely dangerous situation. Not just infant mortality, but maternal mortality was a very, very high thing. And therefore, the Torah cannot command a person to endanger her life. The Torah can tell a man, look around for a mate that is willing to assume that risk. But the Torah cannot tell a woman, you must endanger yourself. And therefore, technically, puruvu is not a mitzvah on the woman. But I was going to say...
Get you a glass of water.
No, thank you very much. But what I was going to say is that... the Ramah says the Bisman Hazeh, our custom is not to divorce for that grounds. But somebody told me the Lubavitcher Rebbe every 10 years would give his wife a get to fulfill the halacha literally. And then he would marry her again the same. I'm not sure if that's true, but he'd marry her the same day over and over again. But he wanted to fulfill the halacha in Shulchan Aruch in a very literal way. By the way, we also know, going to that halacha, that all the years you live in Chutz La'aretz don't count, meaning to say that if you were married 30 years in Chutz La'aretz without children, then you move there to Israel, the 10 years start counting again. And the proof is, basically, that Avraham did not take, right? In other words, the whole idea that you wait 10 years and then you look for options is because Avraham took Hagar 10 years after he lived in Eretz Yisrael. Because after 10 years you make your decision, but he didn't count all the years he was married to Sarah in Chutz La'aretz, that Yeshivas Chutz La'aretz is not min haminyan, because there's a certain merit in the land of Israel. But be it as it may, we were talking about whether there's a mitzvah to seek out mitzvahs, so to speak. So I read an interesting maysa yesterday about Rav Nassim Adler. Rav Nassim Adler was a very interesting person. Rav Nassim Adler was the Rebbe of the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer died around 150 years ago. And Rav Nassim Adler was in Frankfurt. The Chassam Sofer later became the Rav of Preshburg and really was the leader of Hungarian Jewry, but he grew up in Germany, Frankfurt, Germany. And his Rebbe was Rav Nassim Adler, and Rav Nassim Adler was not the Rav of Frankfurt. Rav Nassim Adler was officially a balabas in Frankfurt. And he was a great, great genius. In fact, the story goes, we have nothing in writing from Rav Nassim Adler. In fact, if you know your history well, one of the chief rabbis of England in the 19th century was Nathan Adler. You may see the Machzor, the Adler Machzor. Mm-hmm. And Nathan Adler was the nephew of Rav Nassim Adler. But be it as it may, Rav Nassim Adler didn't write anything down, and he once gave an explanation, because really the oral law is not supposed to be written down. The Chachamim permitted us to write down the Gemara and our Sfarim because there was a fear people would forget otherwise. So Rav Nassim Adler says, since he never forgot anything, he was not allowed to write down the oral law. So none of his things were written down. But he had a lot of trouble in Frankfurt. He was sometimes almost excommunicated because he was very different. Number one, he was a Kabbalist at a time when that was not what was done in Frankfurt. Number two, he had ties to the Hasidic movement, which also was not the most popular thing. Then he was a mystic. He had a separate minyan in his house because he had separate minhagim. And he pronounced things with Havarat Sfardit. He pronounced Sfard, which was not the German way. So he was warned a number of times by the Frankfurt rabbinate to not stop his deviationist customs. No. Now everybody has their own minyan. You don't have your minyan, you have your own minyan. You go to Baltimore, for example, not so much in Silver Spring yet, but you know, every two houses somebody decides to make their own minyan. But in those days, you know, you needed a lot of official permission to be able to make your own minyan and the like. The Vilna Gaon, you know, himself had some trouble trying to have his own minyan in Vilna. They eventually gave it to him. But anyway, so Rav Nassim Adler was a very controversial figure, but the Chassam Sofer always had a tremendous amount of awe and fondness for Rav Nassim Adler, who taught him from the time he was a small child. And he writes about his Rebbe that Rav Nassim Adler understood the ways of Shemayim more than we can look at our hands. The way we look at our hands, he understood the Darkei Hashem and Shemayim, a very great kibbutz. So the Chassam Sofer tells the story that one time a delegation of people came to Rav Nassim Adler to ask him to intercede with the non-Jewish authorities about some decree of banishment. You know, in those days, the city council might just declare all Jews have to be out of town by the end of the week, you know, something like that, and leave all their property, just arbitrary expulsions. So it was the middle of the winter, middle of the night, so Rav Nassim Adler went in an open carriage, and freezing, you know, winds and snow, and the Chassam Sofer, who was 12 years old, begged to come with him, just to be with him and see what it was like. So they're coming, so they're traveling for several hours, and all of a sudden, as always happens, the horses fell into a ditch, and a wheel of the wagon broke, and they're stranded and they can't get out. So what are they going to do? They're in the middle of the forest. It's dangerous and it's cold. And the Rebbe Adler is davening, learning, he's not even aware of what's going on. So the Chassam Sofer tells, 12-year-old boy, tells the coachman a smart thing, why don't you take one of the horses and ride to the nearest town and bring back reinforcements, help. All right, so the guy goes. 3 hours later, he comes back with two sturdy oxen that can be hitched up to the wagon and pull it out of the hole. So Rav Nassim Adler all of a sudden like wakes up as if from a trance, and he starts dancing. He jumps off the carriage and he starts dancing in the snow. He's not even wearing shoes. And the Chassam Sofer begs him to go back. And the Vesna Naila says, "Don't you see what's going on? Don't you see what's going on?" The Chassam Sofer says, "No." He says, "The Torah prohibits plowing with a shor and a chamor, an ox and a donkey. And that also means riding and the like. You're not supposed to hitch two different types of animals together. That would include a horse and an ox. Don't you see that he's about to hitch the oxen to the wagon that's pulling the horses? That's an avera. And we have to stop it." So the Chassam Sofer says, "Oh, you're right. I didn't think about it." So they tell the person, "You can't do that." But then he asks his Rebbe, "Why are you dancing so much?" He says, "Because all of my life I was looking for the opportunity. When am I going to fulfill the mitzvah of not plowing with a shor of a chamor? And Baruch Hashem, I have this opportunity for a mitzvah." He says, "How joyous it is." Now, we associate the notion of joy, if you remember Rabbi Akiva, when they're combing his flesh with iron combs. So he is joyous because he says, "Finally, I have been given the chance to fulfill the mitzvah, the Ahavta Eis Hashem Elokecha, to love God with all my soul." And that's a tremendous madrega that in the middle of his suffering, he has a joy. But we tend not to associate that joy for a mitzvah which doesn't seem to have the same magnitude. But here we have a person who has a tremendous simcha just for a mitzvah like that. So it really shows you that one should have a tremendous simcha when a mitzvah falls into their lap. In fact, they had an Eretz Yisrael a few years ago. Now they do it with some frequency. The mitzvah of redeeming the firstborn donkey, you're familiar with that mitzvah. The Torah says that if you have a firstborn chamor, so you're supposed to either redeem it with a sheep, which you give to a Kohen. The sheep is not a korban, by the way. The sheep is just the Kohen's own property. Or you break its neck. So what farmers do in Israel, first of all, you have to understand, the whole law of firstborn animals is a very complicated law when there's no basis in
it. Why is there such a law? I mean, why does it have to be, animals are so different from us.
Well, there is holiness. The concept is that the firstborn animal has holiness too. Let me go back for a second. If you have a cow, a sheep, or a goat, cows, sheep, or goats, and they give birth to firstborn animals, their firstborn animal, if it's a male, the halacha is, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, that would be given to a Kohen, it would be brought as a korban, which the Kohen would then eat. Now, what do you do today if you have a firstborn, if you have a bechor animal? There's no Beis HaMikdash today. There's nothing you can do with it. So that creates a tremendous dilemma. A Bechor animal cannot be sheared. You cannot use the milk. Well, of course, it's a male. There wouldn't be milk anyway, but you're not allowed to work with it. You're not allowed to slaughter it because it's a korban. So it creates a tremendous, tremendous difficulty to have a korban in your midst. And therefore, the halacha is like this. The halacha that the Gemara says is that if a non-Jew has any ownership in the animal, it does not have the holiness of Bechorah. Mm. So what people do is, before the animal is born, they sell its ear to a non-Jew. So in effect, the non-Jew and the Jew are partners in the animal. And if the non-Jew and the Jew are of course, but the guy doesn't get anything out of it, he just owns a little bit of it. And that's enough to allow the Jew to work with it, to slaughter it, and everything else. He gets a guy that he trusts. Now, although Bizman HaMikdash, it would be improper to evade this by selling, but when there's no Beis HaMikdash, you're supposed to do it, because otherwise you have a problem. So there was a situation that arose. You know this place in Randallstown that has farm animals, Jacob's Ladder?
Yeah.
They advertise for it. So, you know, the people who run it are trying to, teach about the halachas pertaining to animals and the like. So when she started off, she had a problem. She didn't know this law of Bechor, apparently. So she had some firstborn sheep on her land. And the question is, what do you do with it? You're not even allowed to shear them. And think about that. If a little lamb does not get sheared, it suffocates, gets thicker and thicker and thicker, and it's sweating. You know, sheep need, I don't know what sheep do in the wild, actually. Cannot sell it, it's kadosh.
Is this only
male Bechor. So the thing is, the only way out is if you can find that there's a blemish on it, a mum. But you're not allowed to make a mum. So you can't cut it. If you can find a naturally occurring mum, then you're allowed to shecht it, and of course it still goes to a kohen, but the kohen can eat the meat and the like. So, you know, so the Gemara gives us descriptions of them, but most people don't know. I mean, I wouldn't know how to apply it to halacha because it's a very serious matter. So she had to call in Rabbi Heinemann, who looked at it, because one eye was larger than another eye, and there had to be a psak, whether something was a mum. Remember, you're not allowed to make the mum. The mum has to be either naturally occurring or the animal injures itself and the like. So you try to avoid these problems, by, as I say, by selling part of the animal to a non-Jew, but that has to be before it's born, because once it's born and it's a bechor, you can't. Now, the thing is, the Torah's din of bechor applies to human firstborn. Of course, that's fairly easy. You have pidyon haben, you give the 5 silver dollars to a kohen. It applies to cows, sheep, and goats. But the only treif animal that it applies to at all is the gezeiros hakosef about the donkeys. And the Torah gives you the choice of redeeming it with a sheep or breaking the neck. So, as I say, most farmers in Israel don't do this mitzvah because they sell it to a guy, but there was a Svardic chacham who very much wanted to fulfill the mitzvah. He wasn't a farmer, of redeeming the donkey. So he bought a donkey that didn't give birth, and he made a whole ceremony in the middle of Yerushalayim near Mea Sharim, where he fulfilled the mitzvah of redeeming the donkey. They even sent out invitations. And people didn't know, do you say a mazel tov? What do you say on the mitzvah of redeeming the donkey? But this shows, again, the concept of going out of your way.
Why'd you have to break its neck?
Well,
that's the thing that I can't...
Well,
because it's
that's if you
also
don't.
Not right. I mean, breaking is it's
yeah.
Suffering.
Well, it's lav dafka. It's similar to shechting, except shechting is this fleshy part of the neck, and that's
and
the back of the neck.
Yeah,
but that's secondary. In other words, the optimal thing is to redeem it with the sheep. But again, this concept of looking for mitzvahs is something that that we think about, that a person should try to look for opportunities to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But to go back to the beginning of the parsha, there's one mitzvah that's very inexplicable. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, you give a sheep to a kohen, anyone that is a kohen, and that sheep is not kadosh. That sheep is not like a firstborn sheep. A firstborn sheep is a korban, and unless it has a mum, even a kohen cannot slaughter it. But this sheep is the kohen's property. He can sell it. He can give it away. He can eat it. He can shecht it. Huh? No, you have to give him a sheep. You cannot give him the value. You have to get a sheep and give it to him. Right.
The actual
sheep.
If you have the firstborn animal, you have to redeem it with giving the sheep.
No, it all depends. If you have, it's only for a donkey, if you have a firstborn male, goat, sheep, or bull, which is a cow is a male child, you would have to actually, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, you'd have to give that animal itself to a kohen. You cannot redeem it. It's only a firstborn donkey that you can redeem by substituting a sheep. No other animal has that substitution.
So in the times of the 7 days of English, there was a farmer in Bobel, the Jews who didn't go back, they had donkeys, and they had to separate these animals and make a trip to the Shalami?
Yeah, of course, they could save them up to the Gimel Shalosh Regalim, etc. They, in other words... They don't have to bring it right away, but they'd have to segregate it and mark it and know which animal it was, and they couldn't shear it or anything like that, or do work with it. Yeah?
The donkey can substitute by a sheep. Is there a reason for that, a sheep and not a bull?
I don't know. I don't know why. I mean, again, a lot of this is shrouded in mystery. You know, even by a Bechor Adam, it's very interesting. The concept of redeeming a person, the Sephorno writes... You know, the concept of redemption is until you redeem, it's holy. So the Sephorno writes, until a firstborn child is redeemed, the firstborn child has a special holiness. Now, what does that mean exactly? He says he's not allowed to do domestic work. Which is very interesting. No, I understand that. But the Sephorno says, theoretically, the Sephorno says, if you had a 10-year-old who had not yet had a pidyon haben, you could not ask him to take out the garbage. Okay, that's why we do it nice and early. Maybe that's why the Torah said, do it on the 30th day, so there'll be no excuses. But theoretically, the Sephorno writes that an unredeemed bechor is like a korban who cannot be used for non-holy things. We don't paskin that way, actually, but this is what he says, yeah.
But you said that the ear is sold to a non-Jew before the donkey
is born.
And what if it's a female?
Well, that doesn't make a difference. No, let him own the ear. Yeah, let him own the ear of the male. In other words, you sell him something that is non-consequential, so you don't really lose. It's an insurance policy. You don't lose anything either way. Right? Or you can sell the ear of the mother is enough too. You don't have to sell the blood. In other words, if the guy has part of the mother, he automatically has part of the child. Yeah. No, no, the very first child that this mother ever had. It's not per litter. That's right. In fact, let me just tell you something else. I want to go back to something that's more Nogea Elo, but let me just tell you one other fascinating thought of the Vilna Gaon dealing with Bechor. You know, one of the incidents of Bechor is, of course, a firstborn child, firstborn son, I should say, this is not a male-oriented, gets Pishnayim, gets a double portion in the inheritance of the father. And as you know, the criterion for what is a Bechor differs from Pidyon HaBen and Pishnayim. For redemption of the firstborn, it is the firstborn of the mother. Let's assume, for example, a man had children from another marriage. Or two wives, or had children from another marriage, and he marries a woman who has never given birth before. And the woman gives birth to a child, although it is not the father's firstborn, because it is the mother's firstborn, it is Peter Rechem, it is the opening of the womb. So there is a Pidyon HaBen, assuming of course she's not a Bas Kohen or a Bas Levi, but there would be a Pidyon HaBen. However, such a child does not get a double portion of the father's inheritance, because he's not the firstborn of the father. For inheritance is exactly the opposite. Let's say a man who did not have children, Reuven would have gotten the Pishnayim. That's correct. But of course, Reuven is both a Bechor of father and mother.
Yosef would not have gotten it except for the fact that...
Right. That's correct.
The fact that he had Reuven also.
That's right. Yosef would normally not have been a Bechor for double. If a man who didn't have children marries a woman who had children already, so obviously there's no Pidyon HaBen on the child. He's not a Peter Rechem. But such a child is a Bechor of the father and gets a double portion. I mean, that's not controversial, that's obvious. But in Vilna, the following question arose. The question was, a man divorced his wife when she was pregnant. He immediately married another woman who became pregnant right away, and she delivered a child. That's if his wife dies. That's if his wife
does. But if he divorced, he can marry right away.
Yes.
Then there's a problem of paternity, so why do they allow that? The woman has to wait 3 months.
She has to wait. No. If she waits 3 months, there is no problem of paternity. In other words, exactly. She has to wait 3 months to ensure that she's pregnant or whatever it is. But as long as she waits, there is no problem of paternity. We know who the father is. If she waits 3 months, we know who the father would be. So the halacha is a man can get married, if he divorces his wife, he can get married right away. He does not have to wait.
He doesn't have to wait 3 holidays?
No, that is if his wife dies, divorces. Yeah. If his wife dies, he has to wait 3 holidays till he could marry. What happened was, he divorced his wife when she was pregnant, whatever, without getting into why he did that, we don't know. And then he married another woman, she became pregnant right away, and she gave birth to a premature infant 7 months later. A month or so after that, the wife that he divorced gave birth. So it turns out, the question is, on his deathbed, the question arose, these are the only children that he has. So he has these two boys. So the question arose, which of these two boys is the Bechor who will get Pishnayim? On one hand, the child of the divorced wife was conceived first.
Right?
But the child of the second wife was born first. Now, the question becomes, he didn't want, whatever reason, he didn't want the son of his divorced wife to get the Pishnayim. So the question came to the Vilna Gaon, what is the halacha in terms of what defines a firstborn if one child is born first and one child is conceived first? So the Vilna Gaon said right away, the answer is Beferish in the Parsha. The Parsha reads, right, but listen to see how he interprets it. It says, Ki siyeno le'ish shtei nashim. If a man has two wives, and it says, Achas ahuva, one wife is beloved, V'achas sanua, and one wife is hated, and it says, V'yoldu lo banim, ho ahuva v'hasnua. The beloved wife gives birth, and the hated wife gives birth. But then it says, the ben habachor, the firstborn, belongs to the hated wife. So the Vilna Gaon says, the pasuk contradicts itself. It says, V'yoldu lo banim, ho ahuva v'hasnua. That implies, first the ahuva gave birth, the beloved wife, and then the snua gave birth. How could the Torah then say, the firstborn son belongs to the snua, the hated wife? It says, the yaldulo, that the ahuva gave birth first. So the Vilna Gaon says,